Our Bible reading this morning comes from 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verses 25 to 31. That's 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 25. Now about virgins, I have no command from the Lord, but I give a judgment as one who by the Lord's mercy is trustworthy. Because of the present crisis, I think that it is good for you to remain as you are. Are you married? Do not seek a divorce. Are you unmarried? Do not look for a wife. But if you do marry, you have not sinned. And if a virgin marries, she has not sinned. But those who marry will face many troubles in this life, and I want to spare you this. What I mean, brothers, is that the time is short. From now on, those who have wives should live as if they had none. Those who mourn, as if they did not. Those who are happy, as if they were not. Those who buy something, as if it were not theirs to keep. Those who use the things of the world, as if not engrossed in them. For this world, in its present form, is passing away.
Well, it's good to be here in Castle Hill this morning, and great to have the opportunity to speak with you, even if it is through this rather strange disembodied medium of the live stream service. As Kathy and Helen both, I think, said a little earlier, we do long for a time when we'll be able to gather again, God willing, face to face and meet in person. But in the meantime, in the interim, we're so thankful to him too for the technology, the extraordinary technology that makes these live stream services possible, and for the whole team of people week by week in the lead up to Sunday morning and on Sunday morning who work to make it happen. The medium of the service and of this sermon, the medium is the way it is, of course, because of the present crisis that we're in, the COVID-19 pandemic, and the measures that we need to take to restrict its spread. And the topic I want to speak on this morning is precisely that situation. What we can learn as Christians from the present crisis, and what lessons we can take back from it with us into ordinary life as the restrictions gradually get wound back until some sort of normality returns, God willing, across the coming months at some point in the future. So that's my topic. And the passage that I'll be speaking on is the one that was read for us just a few moments ago from the middle paragraphs of 1 Corinthians chapter 7. This is not a sermon about marriage and singleness, though the passage I'm preaching on might have given you that impression. Chapter 7 of 1 Corinthians is, of course, very frequently the chapter that we turn to when we want to speak about marriage and singleness for Christians, and there's good reason for that. Paul in this chapter is responding to questions that have been put to him in a letter from Christians in the church in Corinth about exactly those issues. The Corinthians, it seems, or some of them at least, within the church in Corinth, have come up with the idea of some sort of Christian celibate marriage, where husbands and wives within the church in Corinth, in some cases, have stepped back from a sexual relationship as husband and wife so they can do what they consider to be more spiritual things, like pray. And engaged couples, it seems, are feeling under pressure from fellow believers in the church to pull out of the engagement, to put it on hold or to break the engagement altogether so they can be celibate and single and Christian. And people married to non-Christian spouses are finding themselves urged to consider leaving the person they're married to so that they won't be defiled or spiritually inhibited by their partner's unbelief. That's the theory that has been put to Paul in the Corinthians letter, it seems. And Paul, in his reply, pushes back hard against it. He himself is single, and he's positive about singleness, much more so than a lot of 21st century Christians are, but not for the same reasons as the Corinthians. He insists that those who are engaged are not sinning if they go ahead and get married. And he makes it very clear that those who are married must honour their marriage vows, regardless of whether their partner is a Christian or a non-Christian. And he is clear too that being married involves as an integral element, the sexual relationship mutually and freely given between a husband and a wife that they have with one another. The general principle of all of that is what he says in a kind of summary formula in the verse just before our Bible reading this morning, in 1 Corinthians 7, verse 24. Brothers and sisters, each person as responsible to God should remain in the situation they were in when God called them. Or, a little more literally, as it says on the screen, in whatever condition you were called, brothers and sisters, there remain with God. The call of God to follow Jesus is not, for most of us, a call to leave the ordinary situation, the ordinariness of everyday life and the situation we were in when we were converted, so that we can step out of it into some sort of more exalted, more spiritual situation. For most of us, the call to follow Jesus is a call to stay in the situation God has placed us in and there remain with God, sanctifying the ordinary by the presence of the Holy Spirit. That's the big idea that Paul has been pressing home across the first half of the chapter and the summary that he lands on in verse 24. But it's not all that he has to say in the chapter. And marriage and singleness are not the only issues of life that he wants to speak about. Here in these pivotal middle verses of the chapter, in verses 17 to 31, Paul locates those issues of marriage and singleness within a larger frame, and he situates them alongside all the other decisions that we make about life in the world and all of the other ways in which we organize and order and plan our involvement in the ordinary everyday business of this earthly life. And so the decisions that we make about marriage and singleness become a kind of parable or paradigm for the decisions we make about the whole of life. And he has three things to say, three points to emphasize. The first is the one that we've already looked at. Ordinary, everyday life, Paul wants to insist in this chapter, ordinary everyday life with its ordinary everyday secular responsibilities and earthly relationships is not a situation to get out of as Christians, but one to remain in with God. The God who saves us and sanctifies us is the same God who created us and who created the world that we live in, and in creating it, created all the ordinary earthly things like food and work and sex and childcare. And all of those things that God made are precisely the context in which we're called to serve him and to manifest his presence. Their ordinariness doesn't make them unspiritual. They're precisely the context in which spiritual life is to be lived out. That's the first point. Brothers and sisters, in whatever situation you were in when God called you, there remain with God. The second and the third point, however, are what he goes on to speak about in the paragraph we're looking at this morning. Because ordinary life, for the Corinthians as for us, is not always a stable, tranquil, ordered system. From time to time, disruptions happen and life is thrown out of joint. That is the case for us, all of us, in various ways at the moment, in obvious and unsettling ways in the midst of the pandemic. And it was also, it seems, for the Corinthians. The late 40s and early 50s, the years immediately leading up to when Paul wrote 1 Corinthians in AD 54, were not easy or tranquil times in the Roman Empire. There were worse years later in the century, especially if you were Jewish or a Christian, but the early 50s had their share of instability. The Roman historian Tacitus wrote about the year 51 as an ominous year, featuring earthquakes in various parts of the empire and subsequent panic in which the weak were trampled underfoot. There was also once again in 51 a shortage of corn due to bad harvests in Egypt and as a consequence famine, widespread famine across the cities of the empire that depended on the corn, the grain exports from Egypt. And all this, he writes, was taken by the general population as a kind of supernatural warning. And the famines appeared to have continued intermittently across the next few years, recurring in 53 and again in 54. This was the context in which Paul began organizing the collection for the poor in Judea that he goes on to speak about in 1 Corinthians 16 and again at length in the next letter that he writes in 2 Corinthians 8 and 9. And it's also the context, chapter 11 of 1 Corinthians, in which Paul expresses his outrage and distress about the way in which wealthy Christians, when they met to gather around the table of the Lord and to celebrate the Lord's Supper together, were going ahead and eating and drinking together to their heart's content without waiting to share their table and their food with their poorer brothers and sisters. And it's the context here in chapter 7, verse 26, in which Paul speaks about the present crisis. With all its instability and destabilization and uncertainty, that those who are not yet married might need to take into account as they make their decisions about whether to go ahead with their marriage plans. Paul's intention at this point is not to lay down the law. He says in verse 25, I have no command from the Lord on this. And his purpose in this part of the chapter is simply to offer some advice, as he puts it, to give a judgment as one who, by the Lord's mercy, is trustworthy. You see, a time of crisis like a famine or a war or a depression or a pandemic, a time of crisis can force simplicity on you in a way that you never anticipated. We were invited to a wedding back in March that was scheduled to go ahead on the Saturday of that week when all the rules kept on changing. And as the Saturday got closer, our friends whose son was getting married kept sending out updates as they went from plan B to plan C to plan D. And the whole thing kept getting smaller and smaller, you know, 200 people, 100 people, 50 people, 5 people. We ended up watching the wedding through Facebook like almost every other part of life in the weeks since then. A crisis forces simplicity. Strips back the non-essential services, forces you to ask questions about the essential and the non-essential, compels you to think about which things you really need to do and which things you can do without. And Paul says to the Corinthians, given the present crisis, with all of its uncertainty and instability, there are reasons, there are good reasons, verse 28, why you might decide to avoid or postpone the extra load of trouble and care and responsibility that marriage and children involve. And the same thing is true by extension and analogy about all sorts of other decisions that you might otherwise have made in more normal times, like taking a loan out, or buying a house, or starting a business, or going on a trip. When you're in the midst of a famine or a pandemic, or a war, you do things differently. But what about when the crisis is over? What do you do when the plague has passed? When peace is declared? When the grain price goes back to normal? What will we do when the pandemic is finally over, when the last restrictions are lifted and ordinary life resumes again? That is, I think, the kind of question that Paul goes on to speak about in the second half of our reading this morning, in verses 29 to 31. Because the advice that he wants to give in this chapter of the letter is not just confined to the situation of the present crisis. There's something more important, more permanent, more enduring that he also wants to say to the Corinthians that will continue to apply from now on, verse 29, about the way in which they live in the world, not just in the midst of the present crisis, but permanently when normal life resumes. Normal life in first century Corinth was in many ways a lot like normal life in 21st century suburban Sydney. Competitive, materialistic, globally connected, socially stratified, status obsessed, and appearance conscious. You can read a whole slew of ancient sources that describe life in first century Corinth as having exactly those kinds of features. Roman Corinth was, as one early second century writer put it, the common emporium, like the kind of giant shopping mall of Europe and Asia, the market and the festival of the Greeks. And for some, at least, amongst the Christians in Corinth, a whole lot of elements of that normal Corinthian lifestyle were just carried across unquestioningly into their lives as Christians. So those with money and possessions and status wanted to maintain and display them. Because of course you did. That's what everyone did. That was normality. And those without those things, or without as much of them as their neighbours, wanted to climb the ladder, to get ahead, to compete for possessions and position in much the same way as every other Corinthian. And we, I suspect, are sometimes not all that different. Our culture tells us to compete and consume. That's what a consumer capitalist system is all about. That's the whole machine that we inhabit. Our culture tells us to establish and project our very identity, our sense of who we are, by the way in which we do these things. As Christians, we speak and we sing about following Jesus, but a lot of the time our eating and drinking and buying and selling and the whole shape of our daily lives is unthinkingly shaped and determined not by what we speak and sing on Sunday, but simply by the pattern and the pressure of what is normal in our culture. The tyranny of the normal squeezes us into its mold unless we're very determined to resist and to stand our ground and to do something different. And a crisis like the COVID-19 pandemic, as dreadful, as horrible as it is, also for us brings with us a God-given opportunity. It interrupts the taken-for-grantedness of the ordinary patterns of life, doesn't it? It disrupts the world. It presses the pause button on so much of what we have grown used to, accustomed to, as unquestionable normality. And it gives to many of us a chance to stop and to ask the question, when the crisis is over, will our lives simply snap back into the shape of the old normal, or will we make and retain some lasting changes? Where there are options available to us, and where there are decisions that we get to make, what will life look like in the future? Not just in the present crisis, but from now on. Paul writes, verse 29, what I mean, brothers and sisters, which is not actually a great translation. Really, he's saying a new point. And this too, I want to say, brothers and sisters, that the time is short. From now on, those who have wives should live as if they do not. Those who mourn as if they did not. Those who are happy as if they were not. Those who buy something as if it were not theirs to keep. Those who use the things of the world as if not engrossed in them. For this world in its present form is passing away. You see, the world we live in, this present material world that we inhabit, is a good world made by God. We can live in it and serve in it and participate in it and enjoy it in all sorts of ways, in the ordinary stuff of life, in a way that honours God and gives blessing and joy to others and displays the goodness of God's coming kingdom. It's a good world that God has made, this present world that we inhabit. But we also know that it's not forever. This current world and the present form in which it is configured and arranged is passing away. We are the people who know that. We are the people who have a stake and inheritance in the age to come, in the redeemed and recreated world that will one day sweep away and replace the world that we inhabit now. And so as Christians, if we've grasped that truth and if we're living it, not just in what we speak and sing on Sundays, but if we're living it in the rest of our week, as Christians we live a strange, beautiful, paradoxical kind of existence, don't we? We love, but not as those who expect their friendships and their romances to carry the whole weight of their quest for meaning. Not as those who expect their marriage to be a kind of happily ever after, a Disney movie marriage, and feel cheated when it's harder and more complicated than that. We grieve when those around us that we love pass away, but not like those who have no hope. We buy things, but not as if the things we buy are really ours to keep. They're ours, but they're not ours. We use the things of the world, Paul says, but not as those who are engrossed by them, contained, controlled, defined by the things that we consume. We live in this age, marrying and giving in marriage, loving and mourning and grieving, buying and possessing and inhabiting and working in all the ordinary things of life. We live in this age as citizens of the age to come. And so our lives, if we've grasped that truth, if we've imbibed that gospel, our lives are shot through with that kind of beauty and paradox. I don't know the detail of what that will look like for you. For each of us, the implications will be different. As we think about the hours that we work, the relationships that we invest in, the things that we buy, the money that we borrow, the holidays that we go on, and so on. For each of us, the details of the life Paul is speaking about here will be different. But for none of us, I suspect, for none of us, the answer would simply be to snap back to the old normal, to unthinkingly conform the shape of our lives to the standard ways of doing things in 21st century Sydney. That way of life is not forever. The world in its present form is passing away. And we have a chance, you and I, a God-given chance, in the midst of all the disruption and the strangeness of this year. We have a chance this year and from now on, with the help of God, the wisdom of His Spirit, the fellowship and the encouragement of His people, to live a little more differently, to anticipate a little more vividly the life of the age to come. Let's pray that God enables us to make the most of that chance.